Greetings, listener. I'm Marnie Chesterton. This edition of Earthbeat has been aired before, but it's my favourite, so I'm playing it again. This show is about us and the environment. This week, it's specifically about the things we leave behind, the footprint of our actions. Unless you're an uber green recycler, everything you do will leave some sort of trace. Sometimes that's something small, like a sweet wrapper that goes into the bin. In our first story, it's something much bigger and very, very dangerous. I want to take you back more than 60 years. It's July 1944, not far from the end of the Second World War, and an American ship filled with explosives is in an English estuary, waiting to join a massive convoy that will journey over to France. This ship never makes the crossing, though. It gets stuck on a sandbank, where it stays. A few years later, a young boy called Colin Harvey, who lived on the nearby island of Sheppey in the Thames estuary, was on his way to school.
One day, when I was waiting for my school bus, I was over at the pier. I had about 20 minutes to spare, and I saw, bobbing around on the water, a small thing which looked like a tube of petrol, lighter fuel. So I took my shoes and socks off and waded down and reached out and got this, but it was made of glass. And indeed, there was liquid in it. So thinking no more about it, I put it in my pocket and went to school. When I got home in the evening, I was sitting around the table having dinner with my parents, and I said, "Oh, Dad, I found this over on the pier." And I pulled it out of my pocket and showed him, and he had a quiet coronary. What I had, in fact, recovered was a vial of nitroglycerin. Bomb disposal crew came along and took this item away, all wearing asbestos gloves and things. It's quite a dramatic turn of events. And I was told that if it had broken, it could have hurt at least three or four children within the vicinity of the classroom that we were sitting in, because they're nasty things. Nitroglycerin and air don't mix.
Colin still lives in the vicinity of the island and is now a local historian. And he knows everything there is to know about that shipwreck, including the attempts soon after it grounded to retrieve the explosives on board.
They started to offload some of the munitions and the detonators, because the detonators needed to blow a bomb up, and that was the important thing, to get all that off. And over a period of a number of days, they managed to get just over half of the explosives off the vessel, but still leaving at the end 1,440 tonnes remaining. And on the 25th of September 1944, they left it, and no one's been back on board since. This has now been submerged for 67 years.
That's right, folks. There's a ship just a mile off the coast of southeast England that still has 1,440 tonnes of explosives on board. That includes 1 and 2,000-pound bombs, 2,600 cluster bombs and phosphorus bombs. The ship is called the SS Richard Montgomery. You can still see its masts poking out of the water at low tide, slap bang in the middle of a very busy shipping lane. And if it goes off?
The concerns are a low tide explosion would reach a population of 375,000. The town of Sheerness on the Isle of Sheppey, covering a 7 miles radius, would be destroyed. Now, a high tide explosion would create a 360-degree tsunami wave, which would completely flood a large proportion of Sheppey, the island. We're looking at a remit area of round about 30 miles apart.
I've also heard that the Netherlands could possibly get the tsunami wave that comes across.
I really couldn't vouch for that. The sea defences will withstand a wave of 1 metre. The estimate, depending on tide, of course, is that we could be looking at a wave of about 3.5 metres. So I'll give you an idea of how the sea defences would need to be beefed up in order to safeguard that. The blast remit doesn't exactly include London. You'd certainly hear it. You'd certainly hear it in the Netherlands, I can promise you that.
Wow. The problem is no one knows what to do. At the moment, the wreck is cordoned off and other ships just have to sail around the exclusion zone. It's just too dangerous to remove the explosives. Most people know it's a very dangerous wreck, but even so, when a risk assessment was done in 2009 and it was discovered that some of the cluster bombs were now armed, that was news to everyone.
We were always advised that the fuses, which detonate the bombs, were all taken off. But the cluster bombs are armed when they're manufactured. They're in there. This doesn't necessarily mean they're going to go off tomorrow, but if they're subjected to any vibration or shock, they will. So we have a situation, we've got 2,600 of these bombs sitting on a deck, which is beginning to show signs of collapsing. The underwater images that we've seen recently show it breaking into four parts. It's in two at the moment. Now, if that happens, it's going to give an occasion for the bombs to leach out and fall out onto the seabed with all sorts of consequences. To add to matters, flames last year were observed on the surface of the sea above the wreck site. Now, these were allegedly reported as phosphorus escaping from some of the 1,429 cases of incendiary munitions which are decomposing inside the vessel. And the material was beginning to leak out and come through a hole in the top of the wreck and float to the top of the water. And once it is exposed to air, it begins to catch fire. So what you're looking at is phosphor burning on the seabed. It will ultimately burn out, but it's quite scary, especially if some of the stuff managed to float to shore, and I have no evidence of that. The near misses bother me. I had a fisherman who knocked on my door one evening, and he's a local trawler, and he said, you've probably heard stories of us dropping bombs on the Montgomery site. And I said, yes, I had. What is the story? He said, it's when we go out trawling in the North Sea, we're supposed to report any instances of when we bring up bombs in our nets, radio for the Ministry of Defence, and they come out and cut away the nets and take the bomb away and blow it up. That's the procedure. But they take such a long time to come, he said, and we miss our fishing quota. And so as a consequence of that, we've decided to take our own action, and they just effectively drag the bomb underneath the trawler to a safe place. And in the dead of night, they come round to the Montgomery bomb site and drop the bomb there.
You are kidding me.
And there were nets underneath, and so there was your clue. That's all been stopped now, of course.
But so some people thought, oh, there's quite a lot of explosives, so I'll just dump the other bombs there.
Yes, yes.
Wow. Colin Harvey, thank you very much for telling us the story of the Richard Montgomery.
Thank you.
Now stay safe.
I plan to.
We have pictures on our website. Go to earthbeat.org. And with the 2012 Olympics just about to start in London, I checked whether this thing was considered a threat. Short answer, no, it's too far away. But there are plans to put an airport slap bang next door, which would be more of a concern. I want to take you to one of the world's most extraordinary construction projects. It's in the Scandinavian country of Finland. There's not that much to see from the surface. You need to travel down. Deep down, half a kilometre into the bowels of the earth, to somewhere built to house a problem we've created, the radioactive leftovers of the nuclear industry. Actually, you're not really allowed down there. So here's a message from a man who was. It's dark in the tunnel where he's standing, so he strikes a match and talks to camera, lit only while the match burns down to his fingers.
I am now in this place where you should never come. We call it Onkelo. Onkelo means hiding place. In my time, it is still unfinished, though work began in the 20th century when I was just a child. Work would be completed in the 22nd century, long after my death. Onkelo must last 100,000 years. Nothing built by man has lasted even a tenth of that time span. But we consider ourselves a very potent civilization.
That's filmmaker Michael Madsen in a clip from his latest documentary, Into Eternity. The film takes the form of a message to future inhabitants who might happen to stumble across the facility, people who need to be warned away long after we've died, probably long after people have stopped speaking English. Because this structure needs to last as long as the nuclear waste is radioactive. Since, as Michael explains,
it's the world's first attempt at creating a final or a permanent solution for nuclear waste. So it's a kind of a bunker deep underground in Finland. And what's special about that facility is that it has to last for 100,000 years. And it is actually this time span that I was interested in when I started working with this film. You can say that I believe that it's the first time that mankind is building something that has to last for this time span, and something that's not built in any religious context. And I wanted to find out, what does such a facility tell me about my own time?
This is an incredibly long-term project, and I'm amazed that it actually got the go-ahead. Do you know how it did and how much it's costing?
It's costing 3 billion euros.
And this is all paid for by the Finns?
It's paid for by a tax that was introduced in Finland when they started having nuclear energy.
And this is just for Finnish waste, right?
It's just for the Finnish waste, because the Finnish law stipulates that they should be able to take care of their own waste.
How long is it going to take to build?
They think that they'll be finished in the year 2130 or 50. So it'll take about 100 or 120 years to fill up this repository, gradually filled with the waste. And then the plan is to seal it off, and actually also to hide it, as is the name of the Onkola facility in Finnish, simply to remove all surface buildings and plant a forest, and then it'll look like anywhere else in Finland. And what's interesting about that is, of course, that although the argument is that we should not impose undue burdens to the future generations, which is the whole logic behind trying to do something with the waste. I mean, it's the product of energy that we have benefited from in our age. But when I asked in my research, how does your scenarios for the future look like for 100,000 years? Because when you build something like this, I assume that you would have some kind of idea or various ideas about what the future can look like, because otherwise you can't construct anything that can withstand whatever happens. And these scientists do not expect civilization as we know today to exist in a continuous form. So, I mean, if you look at history, we will see that empires or countries have come and gone, like the Roman Empire or the Egyptians, etc. And knowledge has been lost. And that's really what's expected in this for this facility. And as a critic wrote, that this may be the first post-human structure in the world. And I believe that's the design of the building, to
right.
be able to last without human knowledge.
Which is where it gets really interesting, and just way beyond the whole is nuclear good, is nuclear bad
yes.
argument, because it's all
yes.
about protecting whatever is going to come in thousands and thousands of years' time.
Nuclear energy is this sort of bright, shining light in terms of technology, but there's also this darkness in the midst of this light where we can't comprehend what it really means. And I think you can find the same elements in genetic modification, for example. And it is the first time in human history where we can create something that has consequences, direct consequences, for thousands and thousands of generations after us, potential disastrous consequences. And the paradox is, of course, that even though you perhaps are against nuclear energy, we already have the waste, and something needs to be done. Just to bury it is not even half the solution, because if we can't inform the future or warn them, we will have the problem, I think, of human curiosity. And we do know that the reason why we are having opened the pyramids or anything we find in the ground, that is because we're curious. And that's a huge quality I think we have. But nothing of the things that were buried in earlier times, graves, etc., were meant to be opened, but we do it anyway.
I think if someone found a facility like that in the future, they might interpret it as something religious, a burial ground, or a treasure.
You went down there. Can you tell us what it was like?
the final depth, which is around, I think, 450 meters below ground, that depth was just reached last week in Finland. And when we filmed, the depth was around 300 meters, and it took about 20 minutes in a car to drive down there. And as you drive down, you do feel the pressure increase in your ears, and you do watch this long, 3 kilometer long gallery of bedrock that you drive through, and a whole truck can drive there, and you look at the walls, which is all crisscrossed with numbers and other markings, very, very carefully tracking the cracks in the bedrock, because that's where the water comes from. And the water is what eventually will flush out any radioactivity that may be left, because a facility like this or anywhere else in the world will only be a delay mechanism, because everything man-made will crumble. But as you drive down there and you watch these walls, of course you can't help wondering that if this is ever rediscovered and opened, this will be the cave paintings of our time. It's a purely rational sign, you can say. And I think that's perhaps it's very appropriate, because we are a very scientific society, but it is also perhaps very, very empty beyond just numbers and a love for symmetry, for example, which is also will be something that's significant about that facility. That's all that'll be there.
Did it make you want to add anything a bit more than the rationality? Something, I don't know, something a bit
film,
beautiful?
In the film, you see, for example, there is a scene where one of the tunnel workers has gotten something in his eyes.
It's a beautiful moment in the film, shot in slow motion, in the dark of the tunnel. The beam of the workers' headlamps light each other up. The worker's face is damp and covered in some sort of glitter, and his co-worker reaches up to sweep something away his from eyes. Under his eye.
It's a very sort of tender gesture between the two workers, two male workers. And I wanted to give a little hint about that there is something, or there was something in our time called emotion, something that's some kind of invisible connections or bands between humans, which perhaps are much, much more significant to, if you want to know anything about us, than finding numbers on a wall deep underground.